Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, the theme, How the United States is at War with Itself, and why this is contributing to the growing authoritarianism in the new Trump era. My guest from Canada, Professor Henry Giroux. He holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario, Canada. He was previously the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University and Director of the Forum in Education and Cultural Studies. Professor Giroux is a leader in the field of critical and public studies, and he describes what he considers a different look at society and its issues. He's a prominent advocate for radical democracy, which opposes the powers of neoliberalism and corporatism and religious fundamentalism that diminishes our sense of civic virtue and free thought and well-being. He has also been named among the top 50 educational thinkers of the modern period. Henry has authored many books, and the most recently is America at War with Itself. His website, I'll spell it for you, HenryAGIROUX.com. Nice to have you with us today, Henry.
Hi, Gary. Always good to be back.
Henry, I'd like to begin by looking at the many ways that the United States is its own worst enemy, by starting with the rise of violence in the United States, the rise of violence against women that is rarely discussed. It is discussed if it is a celebrity. But think of all the violence every day in household after household, in domestic violence. Think of the violence against children. Even think of the violence in the workplace. Rarely discussed. Trump won in part by voicing and providing ethical legitimacy to the deep-seated resentments and hatreds in his supporters. And basically, he is saying that violent resentments are reasonable, and he condones them. Not only are we poised to witness increased violence against minorities, against non-Christian religions, against women, against other nationals, and against liberals, progressives, socialists, truthful media, but also against the environment. Everything we might expect under, my personal opinion, a fascist rule. And what is frightening is that these conditions have become the new norm, and people shouldn't expect much to change aside from more oppressive rules and actions being enacted by the Trump White House to keep the population in check and to protect the financial interests of the wealthy and the corporations. So I'd like you to begin, please, by focusing on the causes and different forms that contribute to our domestic war and America's war with itself, and what are the forces enabling it?
Sure. Thank you. I mean, I think you have to begin with the fact that America really is not simply at war with itself. It's actually now a war culture. And what I mean by that is basically America is at war with almost all of its basic institutions that speak to the possibility of a democracy. You have a war on public goods, including the schools and health services, women's reproductive rights. You have a war on young people, which we have seen over the last 4 years under the Obama administration with the increased paramilitarization of the police. You have basically a war on the environment and the Trump, of course, that will be accelerated because we now have a cabinet full of militarists, billionaires, and incompetents. You have a war that's being waged against voter rights. You have a war against civic culture, which is being eliminated under neoliberalism. You have a systemic erosion of any sense of shared citizenship. You have a war on education, which will get much worse under the nomination of DeVos as the Secretary of Education, who is as incompetent as one could possibly get. You have something else. You also have a culture of self-absorption, a culture encouraged by the assumption that self-interest is the highest ideal that people can subscribe to. So you have a loss, basically, of democratic community. You have no commanding visions left in America except the vision to consume and to basically get ahead at the expense of everybody else. And so in a sense, all these moments have come together and crystallized in the form of Trump, who basically has recognized that any sense of shared responsibility now has been replaced by a sense of shared fears. Private happiness has now become a private right. And that what he's done is he's taken all the anger that a lot of people feel by virtue of their atomization, their exploitation, their lack of jobs, and he sort of channeled it in a way to suggest that the only way that that anger could be addressed is to basically blame other people for the problems that they face, whether we're talking about Muslims, whether we're talking about blacks, whether we're talking about illegal immigrants, whether we're talking about Mexicans. So what you have is you have an ecology of hatred that has come to dominate this country, perpetuated not only by, it seems to me, a neoliberal ethic, which in itself is all about winning and losing, but also by echoes of a fascistic past in which you have a number of forces coming together, as you well know. You have this long-term sense of, you have a culture of fear that has been prompted since 9/11. You have a script with repeated attacks on Muslims. You have this appeal to what he calls America in the past, which is nothing more than an appeal to white nationalism, the notion of a white kind of Christian nation. You have this terrible xenophobia that he's mobilized, particularly with respect to the banning of Muslims, people from majority Muslim countries. You have this notion that he alone can solve the problems of the world, that, you know, people need to surrender to this kind of lone leader. And you have an appeal that is basically built around aggression, hatred, and violence. So it seems to me that when you talk about violence and the many ways in which it gets manifested and the causes that have produced it, we're not just talking about Trump. We're talking about a whole range of systemic issues that have been brewing for a long time, especially since the 1980s, of which Trump is a distillation. And I think we've tipped over. We have now moved from an oligarchy to what I would call a full-fledged authoritarian society.
Doesn't in any way remind you of Italy in the 1920s, like 1922, or Germany 1932-33?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, there's the question of the spectacle. You know, there's the question of white supremacy. These are two issues that people don't talk about enough, and they don't see how they're basically related. I mean, and it's not just about Bannon being put into the White House in a position of power, a white supremacist who basically, ran a clearinghouse for neo-Nazis and white and militiamen and other extremist groups. It's really about the way in which the most extremist elements of American society, like Germany in the 1930s, were able to move to the center of politics. And one of the ways in which they did this is they had an enormous set of cultural apparatuses that consistently suggested that they were masters of propaganda. And I think that when you look at what the American media did for Trump, I mean, just following the spectacle all the time. What is the figure now? They gave him $4 billion worth of free advertising. And then when you look at the way in which Trump used that advertising to endlessly make an appeal to what I call racial purification, social sorting, a kind of racial sorting that was endlessly informing his speech. There are two elements, it seems to me, that echo a Nazi and fascist past that many people don't really want to talk about.
All right. I do want to talk about these things because I'd like to open our thoughts up to a broader concept of violence. When I was traveling around the country for 7 years to film the real American pain, not shown in major cities, certainly not shown in most television, and not shown by the mainstream media, I believe that we're afraid to show how much pain people are in. Now, I'm not talking about physical pain now. I'm not talking about heart disease or cancer. I'm talking about the 17 million children who go to bed food deprived. In my personal opinion, that's a form of violence. Of all the people who are working 2 to 3 jobs and are considered lazy by those in power, and especially those on the right, for those in the unions, but not the head of the unions, but union workers, who have lost their jobs to NAFTA or CAFTA or the World Trade Organization, But they still wanted to believe that the Democrats and liberals were there to protect them and honor them. And yet they were sold out to the blacks, to the inner cities, to the Latinos, who trusted that if they gave their vote over for 16 years through the first Clinton administration, the 8 years, and then through the Obama administration, that they were catering to vote for us, we have your interest. So they got elected in no small measure because of the minorities trusting them, and they were sold out. The unions were sold out. The welfare system was turned upside down, and over 1.6 million people who at least could survive now found it extremely difficult to survive because the money had been taken away from the poor and given to the prison system. In fact, we built three times more prisons in America during these administrations than we built schools. All the promises of our improving our educational system were lies. So in effect, I'm seeing pain. I'm seeing violence that has got a silk glove that the hand of violence is wearing. And I think we're confused by the mannerisms, the likability, the charisma of the person in power versus what do they actually do to actually bring violence to us. The ghettoizing of America. Could you address these, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. I think that what you're recognizing and making very visible are two things. One is, particularly since the 1970s, what we have is a socioeconomic financial system that is completely in the hands of an oligarchy, completely in the hands of the financial elite. That financial elite breaks down basically into two parties. On one level, you have one party who makes a claim to still in some way support the social contract, but in a sense really does support financial interests and has no interest in the working class whatsoever, except to voice certain considerations about their suffering that they never address and, in fact, reproduce. Clinton with, of course, the welfare to workfare, and, of course, what he did with the prison system, the mass incarceration system. On the other hand, you have another group who are far more extremist and far more honest in terms of their own visibility and in terms of what they believe in. I mean, these are people who believe that the social state has to be completely destroyed. These are people who believe that inequality in the most massive, rupturing, transgressive forms is basically the outgrowth of a meritocracy. These are people who believe that there's no correlation between economic activity and social cost. And these are people who will sell anybody down the river. These are people who border on being psychopaths. And I think in some way what people have failed to realize is that both parties have nothing to do with democracy. They have bought the notion that capitalism and democracy are the same thing. And in that mythological construction, the kind of violence that often remains hidden in the name of a faux democracy, particularly on the part of the Democrats, has been enormously destabilizing. Couple that with two things. One, you have the destruction of the social state, and secondly, you have the rise of the punishing state. All of a sudden, what we find is a country engaged in what I call punishment creep, meaning that the prison now becomes a model for solving all kinds of problems, whether we're talking about the schools, whether we're talking about criminalizing endless numbers of behaviors that basically place people in the criminal justice system, or whether we're just talking about getting rid of what we call disposable populations. And I think we need a new language to basically be able to address this kind of systemic violence. We need a language that both explodes the ideology and challenges the ideology that legitimates it, and we need a language that suggests that we need new political formations outside of the Democratic and Republican parties. We need a democratic socialist political formation that will bring together various groups from unions to women's rights groups, the people who are concerned about the environment. We need to get away from the fragmentation that often mocks the left. And the left needs to learn how to take questions of education seriously. Education is at the center of politics. If you can't change people's consciousness, if you can't get them to identify in the language that you use what their own suffering means, then they're going to be susceptible and vulnerable to demagogues like the Trumps and the extremists in the Republican Party.
I appreciate those insights. I want to quote something you wrote in America at War with Itself. You said, "Violence in the United States will not stop merely by holding politicians responsible. America has become a society in which the legitimacy of violence is matched by the illegitimacy of politics. What is needed is the development of mass movements willing to resist and replace a predatory system that will assume increasingly intolerant and violent forms of social domination if left unchallenged." Now, mainstream media has failed, in my opinion, and much of the alternative media, especially that which was the corporate liberal alternative media, which there are some, to take this as a basis of critiquing your politics and culture, or our politics and culture, and it's not asking the right questions, in my opinion. So what are the most important questions we and the media and leaders at large should be asking ourselves and addressing to their legislators and the public?
I think the first question that we have to ask is, what does a democracy really look like? You know, how do we characterize a democracy? What does it mean? How do we talk about power in a democracy? How do we talk about justice? And secondly, I think we have to ask ourselves, how is it that this country that once proclaimed itself to be the greatest democracy in the world has become actually the enemy of democracy worldwide? What forces are at work that allow this to happen? Thirdly, we have to ask ourselves, what are we going to have to do to address that issue, not just theoretically, but to invent a new language so as to invent a new understanding of politics? I mean, politics has been emptied out. We cannot define a democracy simply by elections when they're bought and sold. You can't talk about a democracy when basically economics drives politics. You can't talk about a democracy when the formative culture that makes a democracy possible no longer exists. When there aren't public spheres where people can learn how to be critical, to learn how to be analytical. What we now have is a celebrity culture and an entertainment culture and a war culture that does nothing more than infantilize people and depoliticize them. We have to recognize that authoritarian societies are not just about the way in which people ruthlessly produce what I would call tyrannical economic structures. We also have to acknowledge that they produce subjectivities. They produce modes of consciousness. They produce desires, ways of being in the world. And when you bring those two together in what appears to be an almost sutured kind of culture of oppression, it becomes very difficult to step outside of that because it becomes self-serving and normalizing. We have to find a way to denormalize the disimagination machine. We have to attack the disimagination machine. And in doing so, we have to create new understandings of what it means to talk about politics, to talk about democracy, to talk about agency, and to talk about social and economic justice.
Thank you for that insight. I'd like to add something, and that is, there's an old saying, Tacitus, who said, "It belongs to human nature to hate those you have injured." And there's an old Spanish proverb that says, "Since I wronged you, I have never liked you." So what we have is a government, and agencies of government, especially the CIA, the National Intelligence Agencies, the war-making Defense Department, and about 200,000 contractors just in Washington, D.C. and in Virginia alone, that have made it a point of telling us who our enemies should be. And then another group inside of Washington then says, okay, go to work on the media so that we will then dehumanize other people. We will make them seem as if they're the enemy, they're evil, and therefore anything we do to them, if we drone them, if we kill them, it's too bad. And another group of people does it to the American public. Well, if you've got a ghetto, you probably are lazy and you deserved it, and we're not going to go in there because your intent is not to be a constructive member of society. It is, in effect, to victimize people. So now we turn people on each other, and then we're angry at people that do not respond to what they're told to do. And I'm very concerned about this.
I mean, this is a really important issue because what you're basically talking about in a very profoundly important way, in my estimation, is that what happens to a country when people lose the ability to translate individual problems into larger social constructions, into larger systemic problems? What happens is you buy into the myth of individualizing the social, meaning that you buy into a terribly crippling assumption that the only problems that people face are of their own doing, that the only responsibility that matters is self-responsibility, that there's no such thing as collective and social responsibility. There's no such thing as larger economic and social structures that position people in ways that make it almost impossible for them to actually fight the problems that they have to experience by virtue of those structures. And I think that capitalism in many ways, particularly in its most virulent form, neoliberalism, global capitalism, thrives on the assumption that there are no social problems, there are only individual problems. And I think the degree to which people internalize that and not only begin to hate themselves by virtue of that kind of charge, that kind of terrible assault on their character, but they also begin to hate other people. They also begin to believe, well, you know, if people are just lazy. I mean, it's not a matter of politics. It's a matter of character. It's not a matter of injustice. It's a matter of individual responsibility. And I think that the degree to which that weaves through a society and becomes an organizing principle of society, society then becomes organized in the interest of violence. Society then, violence becomes its DNA, because there's no way to solve those problems systemically, because there's no language for systemic reform. There's only the language of punishment. You punish people who are lazy. You punish people who are guilty of not being responsible enough. You punish poor people because they want to be poor. You punish the homeless because they like to live outside. And so it goes.
Hasn't a major failure of the left been its amnesia and rejection of historical truths? Example, consider Hillary and Bill Clinton, who was never called out when she raised herself as a champion of African-Americans and unions, women's and the LGBT persons. But her and her husband's record betrayed this portrayal. The same happens among Republicans, too. So why are the real issues, the real truths, the history that supports those truths consistently overlooked, intentionally ignored, or simply marginalized?
I'll tell you why. Again, a good question, a question I particularly like. Because I think that when you live in a culture of instant gratification, when you live in a culture of the immediacy, when you live in a culture where there's only short-term gains, when you live in a culture in which thought is always chasing after a sentence in which to express itself, when you live in a culture in which people are incredibly atomized, the question of historical memory becomes irrelevant. If not the question of memory itself. Memory becomes a burden, because memory means you have to be informed. But you live in a culture that works endlessly to disinform people. You work in a culture that mystifies consciousness. You work in a culture that says the only orbit of existence that you can live in is one that gives you both immediate gratification and one that basically serves your own self-interest, so that you can get the fastest gains as possible and as quickly as possible, and there's nothing else to care about. When there's no discourse of the social, no discourse of community, no discourse of democracy, and no discourse of struggle, why should history matter?
Well said. That ties into something I read today. I'm sure you've read Robert Reich.
Yes,
he was
of course.
Labor secretary under Clinton. He's an instructor at University of California, Berkeley. He wrote a short op-ed today about the riots in Berkeley and on the University of California campus. I disagree with his conclusions. He has no basis of proof for it. He said that it was all a setup.
And yeah,
he even intimated that Breitbart, as much as I disdain Breitbart, I couldn't see them doing this, because universities should be the one place that we do not have to question our rights of freedom of speech. And I believe in protecting those rights, because the moment I say you shouldn't be allowed to talk because I don't like what you're saying, then someone's going to come along and says, well, Gary Noll, we don't like your progressive thoughts, so you shouldn't be here. In any case, one of the points he made is that Milo was planning to speak in favor of the government ceasing funds to universities, and which is part of his worldview, and that of Breitbart also. And after the demonstrations and riots, that's exactly what happened. Trump has threatened to stop federal funding to the university. So this raises a lot of questions. But one is the control of education, and higher education at the university level in particular, under a totalitarian regime. And is this what we are potentially leading into, and assuming professors who are leftists or social radicals are silenced or forced out of our educational institutions, what do you foresee being the state of American higher education? And one last addendum, please. I believe that American education is being challenged by many different predators for different reasons and ideologues. But I also would love to see educators, tenured or adjunct professors, come together and protest by going on strike and showing that they if they're challenging the curriculum or how it's taught or the administration of it or the nature of the debt burden students have to undergo, any of the thousands of things someone could legitimately say about our educational system, I have yet to see the professors, the instructors, the teachers, even at the local school level, go on strike to share their grievances with us. I'd like you to give us your input on that, since you have been for a long time a professor at several universities.
Oh, there's two issues you've raised, right? One is the issue of free speech, and the other issue is, you know, where are the faculty in light of the fact that universities basically seem to be turning their backs on what it means to take themselves seriously as democratic public spheres. Let me answer the first question. Let me answer the first part first. You know, I really do believe that, you know, any university should be open to the possibility of allowing people to speak regardless of how you feel about their views, because only when they speak in those contexts can they be held accountable. And I think that young people have to learn to hold people accountable even when they don't like the views that are being expressed. So I think that freedom of speech matters, and I think that when you begin to shut down the opportunity for people to speak because you don't like their views, you're treading on very difficult times. But now I'm going to give you a qualification for that. I live in Canada. The question of free speech in Canada operates off the assumption that all speech shouldn't be free. And it's not because it believes that free speech should be censored. It believes that some speech actually causes such damage that if it incites violence, it shouldn't be allowed. And I agree with that. I think that if you get Nazis sort of standing up and telling people that they should take basically kill Jews, or you get racists standing up saying that white supremacists have every right to shoot Muslims, or you get people standing up in a university saying that the police have every right to shoot people in the back, particularly if they're young and they're black, I don't think they should be allowed to speak. I mean, I think there should be some standard to which we can hold speech that elevates speech rather than lowers it. And I think that should be for both sides. That should be for everybody, left, right, middle, and liberals. I'm sorry. Speech matters. But and it matters in a way in which we can't argue that the substance of speech doesn't matter. I mean, you know the saying, you can't yell fire in a theater. Well, I don't think you should yell fire in a university either. And I'm talking about extreme forms of violence. I mean, the kind of speech that is very clearly meant to basically incite violence against other human beings. I'm against it, and I'd be delighted to see universities establish protocols where that can become very clear, and it can be debated before anybody is allowed to speak, so we're not just shutting down the possibility for them to speak. People are coming together and trying to figure out in a democratically engaged way what that means. Secondly, Look, universities are under siege in the United States in a way unlike we've ever seen before. 70% of the faculties in the United States are now are not on tenure track lines. They're what we call casual faculty in various kinds of positions. So it seems to me that, first of all, what you have is a faculty that operates at a level of such precarity that to speak out is to basically lose their jobs. They have no protections anymore. So I am in some ways kind of sensitive to the fact that, you know, these faculties may be less cautious than others. But at the same time, they don't have time. You know, they're overworked, they're overburdened, they're being paid Walmart wages. So we have to be careful. I mean, many of them have attempted to unionize. NYU attempted to unionize. There are a number of universities where they're coming together and trying to exercise a collective voice against what I call the tyrannical impositions of the university. But the real question here is, where are the tenured faculty? And the real question here is not just where are the tenured faculty. The real question here is, why isn't the university uniting with social movements and youth movements to allow the university to be challenged. My friend Robin Kelly, whom I love, who I think is brilliant, talks about this in a way that I completely agree with. And he says, look, this is a struggle for young people. If this struggle is going to go anywhere, young people have to wage this struggle because their future is on the line by virtue of higher education. And now here's my last point. My last point is this. Higher education in the United States is not a sideshow for democracy. It's crucial to democracy, meaning that it is the one of the few places left where you can create the skills, the formative culture that educate people to be both critically engaged and to do something about a democracy that's in crisis. And so it seems to me that once not only the faculty and not only students, but our public in general begins to organize around the university as a public good, then we might see a struggle that matters. Now I want to say, I'm sorry, one last thing. My friend Chris Hedges wrote a piece today, and I really like this piece, or maybe a few days ago in Truth Dig, where Chris says, hey, look, two things have to happen here. We have to prevent this government from exercising any notion of governmentability. We can't allow them to govern, because if they govern, they're going to govern in the interest of being a demolition squad, as Bill Moyers has said. They're going to tear down every basic institution central to a democracy. So we have to go into the streets. We have to go into the universities. We have to go into places where we cause trouble, where you educate people, where you bring people together. But we have to do it nonviolently. I mean, the issue of violence for the left has got to be explicated. It doesn't work. The real issue is education. And the real issue is finding strategies and tactics that prevent this government from basically functioning. And it seems to me that is one of the few ways in which any kind of justice, any kind of what I would call the march towards democracy is going to become remotely successful.
Thank you for those insights. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest is Professor Henry Giroux. He's speaking to us from Hamilton, Ontario. We're talking about how the U.S. is at war with itself and why this is contributing to the growing authoritarianism in the Trump era. We shouldn't fear our government. The government should be there to serve the needs of the commons, all people. It should not discriminate against anyone. And yet what we're seeing now is that virtually every one of our televisions, new televisions, computers, has a camera in it that we're not told about. It's in the contract that will record everything and then give that to a third party, a commercial party. So where is our sense of privacy? That is not something that I and a lot of others would agree with. We want our freedom of privacy, and yet we seem to have no place to be private. We want to be able to demonstrate on any issue, animal rights, human rights, women's rights. We want the right to do that without suddenly being on a Homeland Security and FBI domestic terrorist list. And that's exactly what all of us, I'm sure Henry, I know I am, are on these domestic lists because we provide either our own original insights or we provide a forum for others to share theirs as well, and that's considered a threat. If you speak out against any governmental policy, any politician, or any major corporate interest, if you speak out on behalf of animal rights or the environmental rights, you're now no longer considered a good American, an obedient citizen. And it's not surprising to me that Orwell's 1984 became a best-selling book right after Trump was elected, because people are beginning to see what a true dystopian existence is. And every one of the movements have been infiltrated. We found that out through WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and he showed that every one of the Occupy movements had infiltrators. Some had as many as 10% of the people attending were actual governmental agents. So they're collecting information on people. They're also agent provocateurs. And that's one of the reasons I do not believe that the mainstream media welcomes a Chris Hedges that Henry just spoke about, or would welcome reading one of his commentaries where a major audience, a mainstream audience, could hear it, because the same reason they're excluded from presidential debates. Because if you suddenly had someone who had a radical different opinion of what the order should be and what's wrong with the existing order, it could change people's minds. Now, that said, I believe that we must address the issue of all groups. In the last few years, we've had on Professor Michael Kimmel talking about the rise of anti-feminism, Elworthy Scalia, the British feminist, an Oxford research group founder, Reverend Matthew Fox, who I have a lot of respect for. We went up to Harvard to interview him, and he talked about gender equality and the collapse of a healthy manhood. Guy Garcia talking about the sick male culture, and Dr. Emmett Miller, medical doctor, speaking about gender hatred and feminism, and many others, to let us know that shouldn't we be having forums where we discuss how we are creating our views towards others, and why aren't we approaching the study of our educational system, the study of the influence of the media, the study of our domestic and foreign policies, the study of gender, the study of what is sacred within our culture versus what is dysfunctional, and how many people become conditionally dysfunctional, maladaptive. This maladaptation has allowed what otherwise would be what we would consider normal people to act out or give support to people who are sociopathic, to vote for people who are sociopathic, and then those people act out in ways that are extremely destructive. Could you address this, please?
Yeah, I think, Gary, what I hear you getting at and what I think is important in terms of any kind of radical politics and informed in terms of any kind of resistance that matters is that education is central to politics itself. I mean, Dewey once said, if you don't have an informed politics, if you don't have an informed public, you don't have a democracy. And you know that is not a cliche. I mean, if people are basically schooled to be ignorant, if people basically are schooled in a celebrity culture to become infantile, and if people believe that game shows are the only reality that matter anymore, and become utterly depoliticized, if they believe that the only obligation of citizenship is consumerism and that one of the great temples to American democracy is the mall, and then we're in trouble. And that raises the question, A, you know, where are the public spheres that are available that basically serve to educate people in a way to get them to be able to both learn how to govern and not simply be governed, in order to learn, you know, how to spot and make visible injustices, to learn how to take democracy seriously, to learn to expand their capacities to be critically engaged agents. I mean, I think that, you know, you go back to Hannah Arendt, who understood something very insightfully when she said that the essence of fascism is thoughtlessness, an inability to think. And I think the right has understood this for a long time. I think the 60s scared them to death. I think they never really get over it. And ever since the Powell memo, they've been doing everything they can to wage a war on what I call what they think is dangerous thinking. And thinking becomes dangerous when it becomes critical, when it holds power accountable, when it makes connections. So I think the first part of your question begs the issue of what do we need to do to create the public spheres that allow people to come together to be able to both be educated individually and collectively and to act on that education in a way that suggests that, you know, they can actually make a difference in their lives and in the country, if not in the world itself. The second issue is a little more complex. And the second issue deals with the question of developing a comprehensive politics, a politics of what I call, you know, interrelationships. A politics that both recognizes the differences that mark different forms of oppression, while at the same time bringing them together in a totality in which they both, they complement each other. But at the same time, rather than cancel each other out, they become extensions of each other. And so the question becomes, what's the register that would bring them together? And it seems to me the register is radical democracy. You can't live in a democracy and be a racist. You can't live in a democracy and hate Muslims. You can't live in a democracy and wage war on the environment. You can't live in a democracy and not provide social investments for young people. You can't live in a democracy and allow a criminal justice system to be racially based and to increasingly formerly incarcerate huge proportions of black people. That's not what a democracy is about. And so it seems to me that, you know, one is we need the public spheres that would make education possible in ways that allow people to hear alternative views and views that are not just endlessly marginalized and painted as being dangerous and un-American. And secondly, we need a comprehensive understanding of politics. We need to understand a totality that brings these groups together so that they're unified. We need to move away from single-based issues and bring these issues together so we can understand both their strengths, their connections, and their possibilities in a kind of unity that would allow a different sort of political formation to be mobilized.
Henry, it was about 20 years ago that I went out to California to interview Dr. Kerry Mullis. He won the Nobel Prize for Science in 1998 for discovering the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction. And he's a very casual guy. He's a very easy fella to talk with. He didn't want to sit down at a table. He wanted to walk across the street where the beach was, and so I had my cameraman just set it up, and we did this slow, long stroll. And what was remarkable, at one point, he stops. He grabs me by the shoulder, and he says, "Gary, do you really think that there's a place in this world where wise men and women come to give out their insights and knowledge so the rest of us can have a way of forward?" And I hadn't thought about that. He says, "Let me tell you something. The moment you think people are smarter than you, you've already abdicated." And he gave me an example. Let me share this example. He said that repeatedly he had his Nobel laureate research rejected. But after it was accepted, and after he won his Nobel Prize, he then wrote a completely fictitious and absurd paper. And immediately everyone wanted to publish, and it was published. And he never told him that this was complete fake. It was all made up. And he says, we live with such pretense. And the more knowledgeable you are, the more you have to fear losing your position within a society in a hierarchy, the more likely you are to no longer allow yourself to grow. Now, you just made a statement, and I want to follow up on that. I'd like you to follow up on it. You said this idea of single-driven constructs. And for so long now, people have done two things that I consider are self-limiting. Not that they're not legitimate, they're just self-limiting. People begin to head movements, and then the movement is about them. Yeah. And I began to become, when I wanted to get into movements, I wanted to get into the animal rights movement years ago, one of the very first things I did in my career, because I'm a vegan. And I have a rescue sanctuary. I've rescued and found homes for over 3,000 different animals. And I was asked to attend a animal rights activity down at Macy's. And I said, fine, I'll be there. So I went down, and I felt really bad because I had the guy on my radio show and got my audience down there. And as I pulled up and got out of the car, there I saw a group of people. As women were coming out of Macy's meat store, they were throwing buckets of paint on their head. And if they were wearing a fur coat, they would put buckets of paint on their fur coat. So I went over and I said, you got to stop this. I said, do you really think that pouring a bucket of paint on a woman's head is going to have her have an epiphany and stop eating meat? I said, you're using a sledgehammer when a feather is what you need. And he said, no, this is the way we're going to do it. And I said, well, I can't have anything more to do with this. I'll just go ahead and do my own animal rights. You do what you want, but I'm telling you, you're not going to have converts. You're going to have people looking at you as like somehow you're self-righteous. And also, Mother Teresa ate meat. Does that mean you're going to pour a bucket of paint on her head? Think of all the wise men and women who eat meat. It's their culture. They may not be where you're at as far as knowing enough about these sentient beings, but do you really have a right to transgress that boundary and to punish them for it, to shame them? In any case, I started to see that one movement after the other, the movements were legitimate and should be supported. I just couldn't support the leaders of them. I found them to be polarizing, frequently narcissist, frequently self-serving. So I just went about my own way of helping. And today I believe that we have so many good opportunities to change many things in society, but I believe that we need more humanistic, spiritually evolved people to become involved instead of just the hard-nosed activists who believe that all you got to do is go out there and raise hell, and that's going to get people's attention, that's going to cause change. And as Carrie Mullis told me, that's not the way it happens. You better understand what you're doing in any movement, and you better not allow that movement to be captured by a single select group of people, because then you're following their ideas and their ideology. Could you address this, please?
I think that any movement is always susceptible to what I call the virus of political purity. And I think that when you operate out of an ideology in which shaming becomes the only method for educating people, I think that political purity tends to manifest itself in the worst way possible. You don't convert anybody. You don't change anybody's consciousness when you shame them. I mean, if people are wearing fur coats, we need to talk to them, right? We need to talk about animal rights. We need to understand why they're doing what they're doing. We need to get inside their heads and try to understand that logic so we can connect and build an argument at the very least in which we can come to maybe some sort of agreement where they can at least acknowledge the limitations of what they're doing. I mean, it seems to me that's what education is all about. That's how it works. I think the second issue is that when a movement becomes the central motif for your own identity, then what often happens is that we find ourselves being involved in ways in which our identities are constantly on trial rather than the ideas that we're sort of subscribing to that make up that movement, rather than allowing ourselves to be constantly self-reflective about what they mean. So it seems to me that, you know, there's a kind of inverse sort of colonialism that some activists inhabit, in which through their notion of political purity, they believe that their politics is like a theology. You know, they're saving people. I don't want to be saved. I don't think anybody wants to be saved. I think what we really need to ask ourselves is how do we create the conditions for people to be critically engaged agents in which they can mobilize to address injustices in ways that bear down on their lives so that they have some power, they're convinced they have some power over their lives. You know, there's a difference between being ideologically correct and being a pedagogical terrorist. And my argument is you can be the same. They can both operate in the same moment. You know, you can actually have a position that is, I mean, I've met too many people who occupy political positions I like, but have internalized a mode of authoritarianism that makes them actually unbearable, unbearable to talk to, insufferable to be around, because they actually believe that they embody a truth that has become part of a circle of certainty that is beyond any kind of questioning, beyond any kind of interrogation. These are not people who believe in dialogue. These are not people who believe in some way, you know, holding power accountable, in part at least through dialogue. I mean, these are people who issue orders. I don't want to be a part of any movement where people are issuing orders.
Okay, well said. Over the years, when you have been on this program, as well as Chris Hedges that you mentioned earlier, you have both frequently referenced the emergence of totalitarianism or fascism in the United States. Both of you are scholars about the causes and conditions that give rise to fascism and also its defining characteristics. Well, as of today, Donald Trump has been in the White House for 17 days, and we're witnessing the most rapid flurry of repressive and anti-democratic actions in U.S. presidential history. So would you review those acts that you consider to be the most indicative of fascist regime taking hold?
Well, I mean, one doesn't know where to begin. First of all, to claim that he's building a wall instead of building bridges between people. I mean, fascists build walls, right? I mean, it seems to me that one of the central elements of fascism is both an extreme form of xenophobia and a form of white supremacy, racial supremacy. And I think that that clearly testifies in some way, in my estimation, the wall business and the banning of Muslims to an element of white supremacy, that we an element of official racism, officially sanctioned racism, that we have to address. Secondly, this guy has just said that he wants to support black sites again, that he supports torture. And I know there's been some pullback on the black sites, but this suggests that he basically is willing to engage the United States government in war crimes. The fascists engaged in war crimes. I mean, they murdered people. You know, they committed the most horrendous kinds of offenses against humanity. And it seems to me that in this guy's language that we're hearing are basically the elements of what I would call war crimes. I think, secondly, he has capitalized on a culture of fear to magnify powerlessness and vulnerability, which produces a panicked rage. And in that sense, he kind of drowns his listeners in a sort of verbal waterboarding that channels anger or breeds hatred. That's a classic element of fascism. I mean, his attack on Muslims, designed to demonize an entire class of people, that's about fascism. The notion that as a strong man, he can save the country on his own, that nobody can do it but him, that to me is an echoes fascism. The notion that we're going to make America great again, and particularly, what's the phrase that he used, that Lindbergh used to use? That the fact that the celebration of fascist movements in the past. I mean, he actually echoes sentences and phrases that are applauded by, of course, the white nationalists. The notion that he's going to reduce the counterterror, the terrorist list in the United States only to basically Muslims, and eliminate white supremacist groups speaks bundles, it seems to me, to his support for a kind of a fascism. The anti-intellectualism, the elevation of emotion over reason, most obvious in his denial of climate change. The notion, the culture of self-promotion, the celebrity elements of celebrity culture that he uses, to constantly drive the media. I mean, that comes right out of a fascist playbook, right? I mean, they had the radio and they had huge parades. You know, he now has Twitter and now has these sort of ceremonies that he organizes in which he now goes and talks to his fans. I mean,
but Henry, it's also more blatant in some respects, because there's Betty DeVos, who doesn't have a college degree, didn't go to public education. She's a functional educational illiterate, becoming the head of the Department of Education. But also, I'd make it even more local. I'd like to look at the Flint water crisis as an example revealing how seemingly separate issues of racism and racial intolerance and lack of equality and police brutality and militarization of the police and private interests and plutocratic political motives are in fact all interrelated, and therefore expose a very complex and systematic problem endemic throughout the nation. So could you, in our final question here, could you connect the apparent dots to show how it is violence that underlies the Flint water crisis?
I mean, look, the crisis of Flint is not simply about the fact that there's lead in the water. The crisis of Flint is about the crisis of what I call the politics of disposability, where you have a number of forces coming together that say the following. They say things like, well, in order to save money, we're more than willing to sacrifice human needs over in the interest of profit. Secondly, this is a racially inspired policy. I mean, the people who are considered disposable in this case, in order to save, a few million dollars, just happen to be black. So in that sense, you have a kind of racialized neoliberalism producing the worst kind of violence on young people. I mean, basically condemning young people to a life in which it might be very difficult for them to function as human beings with the capacities needed to be able to engage the world in a way that does justice to who they are. So it seems to me that you have, at one level, you have this culture of cruelty coupled with a culture of greed that adds up to a culture of violence that sacrifices its very children. I mean, that's phenomenal. I mean, it's actually hard to imagine. I mean, when a country eats its own children, punishes black children, basically, criminalizes their behavior, poisons their water supply, all in the interest of saving money. Remember, in Flint, when the auto industry there discovered that that lead-based water was basically eroding their pots, they immediately were given channels of water that actually were fine to use. So you have a governor who is a Republican extremist who was more than happy to satisfy the needs of the financial elite while allowing at the same time to extend for over a year, you know, the poisoning of the Flint water supply. But the other side of this is, look, that governor implemented a managerial system where he had emergency managers come in and, in a sense, oversee these various municipalities. I mean, if that isn't a signpost of authoritarianism, they're not elected. These are people who can destroy and eliminate pensions. These are people who can destroy public institutions like the schools. These are people who can sell off public goods in the interest of private profit. I mean, this is the ultimate showcase for the way in which a fascist notion of capitalism bears down on people in ways so as to cause not just simply misery, but forms of social and literal death.
Henry, we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us today, and all the best on the new book, America at War with Itself, from City Lights Books. Appreciate you being with us.
Bye-bye.
That is Professor Henry Giroux from Canada. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.